The Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee will now come to order. Kiva, please call the roll.
Chair Altman?
Here.
Vice Chair Bell?
Here.
Ranking Member Chambliss?
Here.
Representatives Abbott?
Here.
Black?
Here.
Botana?
Here.
Buchanan?
Here.
Cassell?
Here.
Cross?
Here.
Gossett Seidman? Hart?
Here.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Lopez?
Here.
Overdorf? Trunau?
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Kiva. A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to our Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee. Remind everyone to make sure the cell phones are either on vibrate or turned off, and if you wish to speak, to fill out a card so we'll know who you are and what you want to speak to. We have several items on the agenda today, and we'll begin with our first policy bill of the session. I believe it's our first.
Yes,
it is. So we'd like to, it's House Bill 109 by Representative Kennedy, State Park Campsite Reservations. Representative Kennedy, you are now recognized to explain this very good bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to all the members of the committee. HB 109 allows Floridians to make camping reservations in our state parks 1 month before those who live outside of Florida. This ensures that Floridians whose tax dollars pay for our parks have the benefit of accessing them. This is the bill.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions? Vice Chair Bell.
Well, thank you, Chair. I appreciate you allowing me to ask a question. Representative Kennedy, since you're from my district and a very good member, I would like to know how many parks is this going to, and I'd like for you to name each park.
Sure. So, Rep. Bell, if I could just pause for just a second. Chair, there is an amendment that we probably need to deal with.
Okay. Well, that'd be good.
If you wouldn't mind, Rep. Bell, if we could just pause and and perhaps.
Do you want me to give you the gavel?
I just want to make sure that I don't miss out on something you would like me to handle.
Back to you, Chair. And while you're doing that, if you will think of every park in the state of Florida.
Right.
Sure. Absolutely.
Any other questions? Then at your request, we'll move to the amendment, which is barcode 2. Do you remember the barcode number?
Certainly, 233243.
Great. Okay, good. Please explain your amendment.
Certainly. And Chair, thank you for that opportunity. I appreciate it. This is a very simple amendment that just does a couple of things. The first thing it does is change the time frame from 11 months to 10 months and changes the effective date from July 1st of 2023 to January 1st of 2024. This is the amendment.
Now, this is a real question. Explain the difference in the time frame, 11 to 12, or the way it's worded.
Yeah, sure, exactly. The purpose of the time frame is a couple of reasons. The first is in conversations with DEP, it was a simpler fix for them to leave Floridians at 11 months in terms of when they're able to make a reservation and move those who do not hold a Florida driver's license to 10 months and rather than 11 months and 12 months. So it just is a shift of a month that makes it a little easier to execute.
And what problem does that solve?
Chairman,
yes.
It is interesting, there was a change.org petition with more than 10,000 signatures that asked for this problem to be addressed. The biggest issue is that Floridians just simply can't get into the parks that that we pay for and would like to access.
That's great. Okay. Are there any other questions of the sponsor for the amendment? Yes, Representative Chambliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. I was wondering, does this amendment create a carve-out for Tom Brady so that he can stay in the state of Florida a little while longer? Just wondering.
May I?
Yes.
Thank you for that question, Rep. Chambliss. It does not create a specific carve-out for Tom Brady, though if I had thought of it, I would have made every effort to specifically make that happen. So I appreciate that great suggestion, and I will take that under advisement for the future. Thank you.
This bill has other stops, so maybe in the process, you could work on that. Yes. Go ahead. Yes. Representative Obrador.
Thank you so much. In light of the good Representative Chambliss's suggestion, maybe we should alter the residential status to 12 in celebration of TB12, and therefore looking at the 12-month for Tom Brady's 12, and just wondering if that's a consideration instead, and therefore possibly lobbying him to stay within our great state.
Chair. Representative Everdorf, thank you again for that really extraordinary suggestion. Certainly keep it under advisement and appreciate the love for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and certainly for Tom Brady. So thank you.
Thank you for this good bill, Representative Kennedy. Can you name your favorite state park and please tell us why in a very short haiku?
Chair? No.
Okay. That's a very good answer. One of the best I've ever heard. Yes, Representative Botana.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Kennedy, this is a great bill. We talked about this bill months ago when it came up and appreciate it. I seen it at his first stop, but I was amazed today, like I got here. I never had a phone call or a question about the amendment or anything, so I'm just kind of surprised about that. I mean, I don't know if I can really see where this goes from here, but, you know, what really does this amendment, when it comes from 10 to 11 months, why was it just picked from that? Could it be 9 months? I mean, could you just explain a little bit more on that amendment, please?
Chair. Rep. Botana, thank you for that excellent question. The amendment very simply acknowledges that sometimes it's wise to listen to our departments like DEP and make some accommodations that just make things a little bit easier to manage. And you are right. I failed to come and speak with you individually about this very significant change, and I will make absolutely sure that never happens in the future. Thank you so much.
You know, if it make it easier, we could TP the bill and give you an opportunity to meet with Rep. Botana. Would you like to do that?
Chair?
Yes.
No.
Okay. Okay, do we have any other questions on this? It's really a great bill.
And Chair, if I may, I failed to answer Representative Bell's question earlier. May I respond?
You're not recognized, so I just want to finish what I was saying. This is a really good bill, and we appreciate you bringing it to us. And yes, you're welcome. Unless you have another interruption you'd like to make of the chair. You're at two.
May I?
First-time bill. That's not bad. Yes, you may.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Bell, you asked me about state parks, 175 all across the state of Florida. And I have not visited them all, but I would love to invite you to join me to hike each and every one of them.
May I?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Representative Kennedy, and I look forward to hiking with you on all 175 parks.
Yes.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Do we have anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? You sure? This is her first bill. No. Okay. Seeing none, you have a very kind audience here. Is there any debate on the bill? You recognize the close.
Wave close.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Is anybody opposed to this amendment? And without objection, show the amendment adopted. We're back on the bill as amended. Are there any questions of the sponsor on the bill as amended? I think we're good. I think we've exhausted all questions. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Is there any debate? Seeing no debate, Representative Kennedy, you're recognized closing your bill.
Wave close.
Thank you. So, Representative Kennedy, having closed on the bill, Kiva, please call the roll.
Chair Altman?
Yes.
Vice Chair Bell?
Yes.
Ranking Member Chambliss?
Yes.
Representatives Abbott?
Yes.
Black?
Yes.
Botana?
Yes.
Buchanan?
Yes.
Cassell?
Yes.
Cross?
Yes.
Gossett Seidman?
Yes.
Hart?
Yes.
Killebrew?
Yes, ma'am.
Lopez?
Yes.
Overdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
True now?
Yes.
Yeas, Mr. Chair.
All right, members, by your vote on House Bill 109, your 109 will be reported favorably as amended. And thank you for being such a good sport in your first bill. It's a great honor to serve with you. This bill is a huge bill because it's just one of many issues where Floridians are kind of shortchanged. And I hope this is the beginning of kind of fixing some of those inequities. It's pretty sad when you live in Florida, you pay Florida taxes, and you can't even get a place to put your camper. Because I'm even hearing that getting a campsite is kind of like going to StubHub, you know, where people are reselling. But it's a good bill, and thank you for bringing it for us. Okay, members, our first presentation this morning will be given by Derek Buchanan, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. He is here to go over Commissioner Simpson's legislative budget for fiscal year 2023 and 2024. Now, this is the Commissioner's first legislative budget.
It is.
But
it
we're not going to harass you.
I hope not. This is not my first budget presentation, so right. I appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and representatives. I want to say thank you on behalf of Commissioner Simpson for giving us the opportunity to be here today to talk about our legislative budget request. I'm going to start by giving you a very brief overview of the department's current year budget, which supports 3,776 FTEs and totals $3.2 billion. That budget's broken down even further into $560 million of general revenue, $412 million in state trust funds, and a healthy $2.2 billion in federal funds. Our budget is organized into six program areas that contain the 16 division and offices that you see on your screen. Our largest division and office from a budget perspective is Division of Food, Nutrition, and Wellness. It accounts for about $2.2 billion of our $3.2 billion budget. That division houses our school nutrition programs and is primarily federally funded. The largest of the remaining divisions is our Florida Forest Service, which has about a $574 million budget and supports 1,180 FTEs. That's by far our largest division from a staffing perspective. They account for almost one-third of the department's employees. Our legislative budget request for next year totals about $1.8 billion, which is a large number, but if you look at the slide, you can see there that about $1.3 billion of that, or 73%, is federally funded. That's primarily attributable to federal funding increases in our school nutrition programs. The remainder of our request includes $85.3 million in general revenue funds and $398.2 million in state trust funds. About $300 million of that state trust fund amount is associated with our rural and family lands program, which you'll hear me talk about a little later in the presentation. So our budget request seeks to achieve two primary goals. First is to modernize the department's pay and infrastructure to better serve the citizens of Florida. And the second goal is to preserve and grow Florida's ag industry while protecting the environment. So up first under our modernizing goal is a $20.2 million pay increase for our employees. That consists of about $10.9 million in general revenue and $9.3 million in state trust funds. $10.2 million of that issue will be used to establish a new minimum pay of $40,000 within the department. Currently, the department has over 1,500 positions that make less than $40,000. Some examples of those include lab staff, and those include things like chemists, laboratory technicians, biological scientists, many of our fire support positions in the Florida Forest Service, so things like foresters, duty officers, and equipment mechanics, and then many of our inspection classifications across the department.
The other half of that issue, about $10 million, would be used to address compression issues resulting from that new minimum pay, as well as new minimums that were established for state law enforcement and state firefighters last year. We have several instances in the department where supervisory staff are paid the same or very similar to their direct reports. This funding would help alleviate those issues. And then the last pay issue on here is a reduction of 120 vacant FTEs without any associated budget. This would allow us to right-size our staff and apply those savings to our remaining positions. We feel like this issue combined with the pay issue above would really help improve our recruitment and retention efforts. Next up, in addition to the pay issues, we have several infrastructure and equipment requests. The first of these is $31 million in general revenue funding for a new consolidated workspace out at our Connor Complex in Tallahassee. We're very thankful last year the legislature provided us funding to conduct a feasibility study that looked at vacating the Mayo Building and our other lease space in town and moving to a newly constructed building out at the Connor Complex. That study has been completed and does recommend going forth with a construction project. This funding would provide $31 million in pre-construction cost on what is expected to be about a $208 million project. Once complete, it would house about 940 of our Tallahassee-based FTE and would allow us to vacate the Mayo Building and all of our other lease spaces in town. Second issue on here is $1 million in general revenue funding to study, review, and replacement renovation options for our dated laboratory spaces. Department operates a number of labs associated with food safety testing, petroleum testing, weights and measures, and fertilizer, feed, and seed analyses. Our primary lab spaces were built in 1969 and no longer meet modern technology requirements. This issue would allow us to do a study to sort of take a comprehensive review of our lab space and determine the best course to go forward with. And then the last issue on here is $13 million in trust for maintenance and repairs of state forest facilities, roads, and bridges. The Florida Forest Service is responsible for 38 state forests and Babcock Ranch. Those state forests include thousands of facilities and over 3,000 miles of roads. Those facilities and roads require routine maintenance. Forestry would use their existing staff and equipment on many of these repairs to ensure that the dollars go as far as possible. This next slide has some additional equipment needs as well. The first is $17.9 million in trust for fire suppression equipment, including three fixed-wing aircraft. Again, the Florida Forest Service has a fleet of about 2,000 pieces of equipment and 31 aircraft. This funding would provide for a replacement of that equipment that exceeds DMS recommended replacement criteria and would help ensure that our firefighters have what they need to do their job safely. The second issue on here is $10.6 million, which is comprised of $4.4 million in general revenue and $6.2 million in trust for new and replacement vehicles and vessels across the department that exceed recommended purchasing criteria. This issue would provide for about 200 replacement vehicles and 10 vessels. These are vehicles and vessels that are used by our ag law enforcement officers, our inspection staff, and our Division of Aquaculture. And then the last issue here is $4.3 million in general revenue funding to update our information technology system. We would use this funding to begin bringing some of our legacy systems onto more stable and modern IT platforms. I'm going to move on now to sort of our preserve agriculture while protecting the environment goal. Here we have several Forest Service issues I wanted to mention. The first is our Rural and Family Lands program. We're seeking $300 million in trust for that program to acquire perpetual conservation easements. This is the program that Commissioner Simpson spoke to you all about a couple of weeks ago. It has three primary benefits. The first is that it keeps the land in ag production for future generations. Second is that it keeps the land on the local tax rolls and supporting those local government services. And the third is that it doesn't cost the state anything to maintain these lands going forward. Second issue is also related to rural and family lands. It's for 10 FTEs and associated costs of $1.3 million to assist with program administration. These positions would help with project evaluations, acquisition and closing tasks, as well as ongoing compliance monitoring once those development rights are acquired. And then the last issue here is $5 million in trust for reforestation projects. These funds would be used to help counties, municipalities, and private landowners with reforestation costs. Up next, we have some of our ag water policy issues. First one here is $15 million in trust and fixed capital outlay funding for nutrient reduction and water retention projects. These would be large-scale regional projects completed in coordination with DEP, the water management districts, and private landowners. The second issue there is for $10 million in trust for farm-level BMP cost-share projects. These are smaller-scale projects. Our BMPs are practical measures that farmers can take to reduce the amount of nutrients entering waterways while maintaining ag production. These are things like soil sensors, irrigation retrofits, like I said, smaller scale on-farm projects. And the last issue here is, again, water policy, 17 FTEs to deal with workload in the Office of Ag Water Policy. These positions would allow the Office of Ag Water Policy to perform more on-farm technical assistance, more BMP enrollments, and more BMP compliance monitoring. And the last area I'll talk about is our citrus industry. It's certainly an industry that needs our support right now. We have four issues aimed at helping to preserve that industry. The first is $6.5 million to continue our citrus health response program. That's a partnership with the feds. It's primarily federally funded. Its activities include things like pest surveying, compliance monitoring, and budweed protection. Second issue there is $8 million in trust for additional disease research. That's the historic funding level that we've been putting in there each year. The third issue is $1 million in general revenue to expand our citrus budweed greenhouse space. As more and more trees are lost, our need for additional budweed capacity grows. So that's what's going on with that issue. And then the last issue there is $4 million of GR transfer funding to support our Citrus Inspection Trust Fund. That trust fund has historically been funded by citrus box taxes, but as the crops have gotten worse and worse, the financial standing of that fund is at the point where we need GR help to avoid raising taxes on struggling growers. And that is everything I have. I'm happy to answer any questions you all may have.
Okay, Representative Cross.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate the presentation, Mr. Buchanan. I have, I think, two questions.
Okay.
One related to the Rural and Family Lands Program. I understand that in moving some of these projects through the pipeline, that sometimes we get a kind of a bottleneck at the appraisal process. Of those, I think, 10 new FTEs, do you anticipate adding any appraisers to the Department of Forestry staff?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I think absolutely. And we're working internally now to sort of reprioritize staff to help with that issue as well. So we're currently trying to address that within existing resources.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, one more. Perfect. So looking at some of the citrus issues, we know that that's a big concern for our state. The citrus BMP manual has not been updated since 2012. And there was also a bill last year, SB 1000, the nutrient application rate, which allows for additional application of fertilizer on citrus crops. Does the department have a plan for updating the BMP manuals in general, and specifically how that bill will impact citrus BMPs?
Mr. Chair, I think the department absolutely has a plan to update all the BMP manuals. I don't know that plan at the moment, to be honest with you. I think we're on week six on the job, but I'd be happy to get more information for you on that issue. But I do think absolutely we're working on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. You're requesting an additional $300 million for the Rural and Family Lands Program, but last year you also asked and received $300 million. And I'm just trying to figure out, I know it'll take you some time to get geared up, but have you spent any of the first $300 million? Because you just got it in January, so have you spent any, or is it allocated out? Can you tell us why you're asking for $300 million more right now?
Mr. Chair, yes, so we absolutely think we're going to spend the first $300 million this year. Those projects have to go to Cabinet for approval. Our next opportunity is March Cabinet meeting, followed by the May Cabinet meeting. I think by then you will see us bring projects for to spend those dollars. We have an approved list. That list was last approved in 2017. It's got about $1 billion worth of projects on it. We think we can spend the first $300 million easily on those projects. And like I said, we hope to do that within the fiscal year. The other thing we're going to do at the same time here shortly is we're going to open up that list again, because like I said, it has not been, that list was last approved in 2017. We think there are more properties out there, more landowners that would like to apply and get access to these dollars. Like I said, we currently have a $1 billion list. We think we're going to spend $300 million of that in the current year. We think that list may grow more than $1 billion. So that's, again, why we're asking for an additional $300 million.
Representative Trunell.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair. Can you elaborate a little bit on the 120 vacancies for FTEs you have and your right sizing of staff levels, so I can understand that? And I have a follow-up afterwards.
Sure.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So we currently in the department have over 500 vacancies. It's something we're struggling with, hence the pay issues. And what we did, we looked at, so we know we have 500 vacancies. The commissioner wanted us to come in and look at, on top of asking for money for pay, are there things we can do internally to help that issue as well? So what we did, we looked at sort of the lowest level of vacancies we've had over the past 5 years. I think that was around 180 FTEs. So we took an amount that was less than that. And the thought process there was, okay, if we haven't had that level of FTE in 5 years, we should be able to remove at least something less than that and not impact our service level. And then the second part of that is if we get to keep the salary associated with those 120 and put back into our other positions, then hopefully the entire thing is a net gain for us. We bring down our vacancies to a level that we haven't seen before, and we've improved pay for everybody else.
You good?
Yeah. Follow up on,
yes,
on another issue. So going back to the rural family and lands, so you guys have a lot in the backlog. Where do you see yourself at the next cabinet meeting? Are you... How many of those are you going to bring forward, and what kind of dollar amount is that going to be?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think we have about three or four properties that we're hoping to bring to that March cabinet meeting. I think we have 10 to 15 that are really in the hopper that we think, if not March, May. I'm not sure about the dollar amount. I'd have to get the specifics for you on that. But like I said, we're absolutely trying to turn that list over as quickly as possible.
Good. Representative Killebrew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 9, this agricultural water policy issues, $15 million in trust fund fixed capital outlay, funding to address agricultural nutrition, nutrient and reduction in water retention project. Can you tell me a little more about that project?
Yeah, absolutely. So that would be, like I said, regional ag non-point source projects that we would work with DEP or the water management districts on to sort of identify those areas where maybe there's a dairy that needs a significant lagoon restructure or some other type of ag-related non-point source where we could go in there. It may require some more extensive work, some engineering, hence the reason we're asking for fixed capital outlay. And like I said, we'd be working with DEP and the water management districts to identify those projects and where those projects would be. Historically, we've asked for funding around Lake Okeechobee and outside of the Lake Okeechobee area for those projects. I think that we recognize that there's been a lot of attention in Lake Okeechobee. Maybe there's some needed funding outside of Lake Okeechobee. I think we'd like to move to more of a statewide approach where we wouldn't be limited by geographical area necessarily.
Thank you. So, again, you just said you want to try to get away from, not necessarily away, but more into the state. So the object is the waters that are coming into the Peace Creek and places like that and going into Okeechobee. The more we can do to clean up that water, then that's where some of those funds could go to help with that.
Absolutely. Could be your northern Everglades, could be in North Florida in a spring shed area. Like I said, wherever the problem is that's driving the pollution in that waterway. If it's an agricultural related issue, we would be involved in that, and that's what some of this funding would do.
Representative Cassell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Buchanan, for your presentation. I wanted to turn back to the request for the $300 million for the Rural Family Lands Protection Program. While it indicates in the presentation that it's going to be to acquire perpetual conservation easements, we know statutorily the department has the ability to also consider, I believe it's 30 years.
It
so complete, okay, correct, 30 years. I just want to make sure that it is the intent of the department that we are going to, if this funding is provided again, that the intent is going to be to acquire these lands for perpetual conservation easements and not utilize that 30-year option.
Yeah, that's absolutely our intent.
And that's a good thing. So I appreciate you asking that question. Okay, do we have any other questions here? I do have a couple on slide five, where you've set the minimum pay of $40,000 per year. I know I don't think any other state agency, I know the legislature, I don't know if anyone in state government does that.
No, if you'd like me to respond, no. We have set minimums for certain, like state law enforcement officers and state firefighters have had minimums set. We did set a minimum of $15 per hour last year, I think the legislature approved, which equates to around $31,000. But no, this is new. I certainly think as a legislature, if you're looking at this issue, you would probably want to consider statewide, right? We understand the bigger picture. You're not just focused on Department of Agriculture. You have to consider all state agencies. And I do think that's a worthy cause to look at. For our budget, we simply wanted to highlight the fact that we do indeed have 1,500 of our employees that start below $40,000. And it's a reason why we have 500-something vacancies at the moment. It is a challenge for us.
Yeah, I could understand adjusting those areas where you're having trouble hiring people upward. I'm all for that, been for that. But a flat minimum pay, would that apply to interns?
No, we'd be talking about full-time FTEs. So
any full-time
not OPS positions, but our full-time FTEs that you guys authorize in the budget.
So worthy goal. It's something that typically and historically we've tried to apply all standards all across the board.
Yeah.
At times that's frustrating as a legislator, but it probably does make things clearer in terms of how we advertise, treat employees equally across. But it's a bold step. It's a very bold step, and I was curious how that applied.
Yeah, and just I want to be clear. So that would just set a minimum. We do have the compression issue that would then be used to sort of keep some of those steps that are already in place, because right now, like in our finance,
see that in the next line.
Yeah. So, like in our finance and accounting staff, we have accountants 1s, 2s, and 3s. All of those make less than $40,000. If we set that new minimum, they would all be compressed, and then we would use some of those additional funding to keep some of those steps in place. Essentially,
great. I also on slide six, the $31 million in general revenue funding for. Design and site work for a new consolidated workspace located at the Connor Complex. And you had mentioned that's just design and site work. The total cost of that new facility is how much?
It's estimated to be about $208 million. It's a substantial investment.
Not questioning whether that's needed or not.
No.
My question is so many folks in the private sector and in a lot of private sector projects of this size, they typically bond to finance these type of programs because the concept is a $208 million project that's designed to last how long? What's the life cycle of that?
It's at the end of 30, our report looked at a 30-year outlook and the building was still worth $50 million, right?
Yeah.
So it's a substantial life cycle. Yeah.
So if you bond that, you spread the cost of that capital improvement over the next three generations that will be enjoying the use of that building. That's why we do that with water plants and sewer plants and government centers sometimes. Have y'all, so you're not bearing the full burden on Floridians immediately.
Yeah.
Have y'all considered doing that? And by the way, you have tax-exempt bonds for the public sector, so you get the lower rate.
We have not. Like I said, I'm not aware of the department individually being able to bond. You know, if the state wanted to bond for capital outlay projects, then yeah, absolutely. I think that's an option. And I know it's been an option in the education capital outlay area for years and years and years. So yeah, I think that's absolutely an option. We simply asked for 31. We knew $208 million was a large number. We know it's going to take several years to construct a facility of that size. We thought we would start with $31 million, which was basically the A&E and the site work, right, and some of the impact fees.
Yeah. And sometimes you need that prior to going to a bonding. $300 million for Rural and Family Trust on page 8. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah.
Thumbs up. Thumbs up. Okay, it was a good request. So I hope we can help you on that. I know that will be a process.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate what what Department of Agriculture is doing on its rural and family lands. It's long overdue. All right, I think that concludes all of our questions. Thank you so much. Excellent presentation.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Our next presentation we will be given by Adam Blaylock, Deputy Secretary for Ecosystem Restoration from the DEP. He will be providing our subcommittee an overview of the water quality issues in the Indian River Lagoon and the proposed governor's funding for fiscal year 2023 and 24. And Mr. Blaylock, you are recognized. Having sit on water quality, and imagine we have a lot of members on natural resources, we officially give you a frequent flyer card for being before our committee.
To be able to present on Indian River Lagoon, to give kind of a historical perspective where we are now and where we're planning and what we're doing as far as water quality moving into the future. And again, my name's Adam Blaylock, Deputy Secretary of DEP for Ecosystems Restoration. And just for a little bit of background on the Indian River Lagoon, it's a 156-mile-long estuary along Florida's east coast, and there are six coastal counties in the natural IRL watershed. From north to south, these are Volusia, Brevard, Indian River, St. Lucie, Martin, and Palm Beach counties. The Indian River Lagoon has faced challenges over the years. By the 1970s, 75% of the lagoon's salt marshes were lost when dikes were built to separate 40,000 acres from the waterway to control mosquito breeding. In addition, watershed, wastewater, and stormwater discharges, along with freshwater discharges from the St. John's and the Lake Okeechobee, have degraded shellfish habitat and native vegetation, also resulting in soils, sediment, and nutrients flowing into the lagoon. However, multiple agencies, organizations, and other stakeholders have worked to improve the system's water quality and ecosystem. Some of these initiatives have included designating the lagoon as a Surface Water Improvement Management Act basin in 1987, otherwise known as a SWIM plan, creating the Indian River Lagoon National Estuary Program in 1990, eliminating effluent discharges to the lagoon from more than 40 wastewater facilities, reducing and diverting freshwater discharges away from the lagoon, land acquisition of environmentally endangered land within the lagoon's watershed, muck removal from the IRL and various tributaries, restoring ditches and wetlands, and conducting water quality monitoring and research. In addition, the department's developed water quality standards, total maximum daily loads, and basin management action plans to implement water quality restoration within these watersheds. And for those of you that are on Chair Stevenson's committee, you've probably heard the water quality overview, but for those that are not, I'd take kind of a quick kind of 67 crash course in water quality standards. But basically, looking at nitrogen and phosphorus, and this pertains really to all pollutants, but DEP does water quality assessments and sets water quality standards and criteria, which basically is just the amount of pollutant, in this case nitrogen and phosphorus, that can be in the watershed without causing water quality issues and impacts to the ecosystem. And then we do water quality monitoring. And if the water goes above those concentrations, then we designate that water body as impaired, and it gets put on an impaired waters list that then goes to EPA for approval. Once a water body is deemed impaired, we do total maximum daily loads, which basically just sets the amount of nitrogen or phosphorus that the particular water body can obtain without causing adverse ecological impacts. And then once we know what that total load capability in the waterway is, then we develop basin management action plans, which then determines out of all the stakeholders and entities that discharge that nitrogen or phosphorus, what is the amount that's allocated towards them, and if their allocation is, or if their actual discharge is above that allocation, then they have to do projects that will then reduce the loading to meet their allocation. So once all of those have been accomplished, you've met the TMDL, you've met water quality standards, and presumably you've then see the environmental and ecosystem improvement. And then if not, there's further assessments and water quality analysis to determine why, whether or not the load allocations need to be updated or additional load allocations to address future growth that has occurred or otherwise until you see the environmental response that the water quality criteria are intended to make. And because the IRL is a large geographical area, we've broken up the lagoon into three BMAPs, the North Indian River Lagoon Basin Management Action Plan, the Banana River Lagoon, and the Central Indian River Lagoon. These waters address were verified as impaired due to excessive amounts of phosphorus and nitrogen based on evidence of decrease in seagrass distribution provided by the St. John's River Water Management District, and low DO as verified through our water quality assessments. These waters were added to the verified list for impaired waters in 2007. Nutrient and dissolved oxygen total and maximum daily loads were developed for the Indian River Lagoon and Banana River Lagoon within the larger IRL basin in 2009, and additional TMDLs were adopted in 2013. So basically the purpose of these TMDLs is to establish the allowable loadings of phosphorus and nitrogen that would restore these water bodies such that they meet their applicable water quality criteria for nutrients, and that allows conditions necessary for seagrass growth. So the basis and what we're looking for as the water body meets those water quality standards is seeing the environmental response to increase seagrass growth. So three BMAPs have been developed to address the TMDLs and impairments in the three sub-basins. Again, the Central IRL, the Northern IRL, and the Banana River Lagoon. DEP first developed these BMAPs in 2013, and in 2021, they were updated based on several changes since the adoption of the 2013 BMAPs, including updated modeling efforts, boundary adjustments, updated allocations, and load reductions to the responsible stakeholders. This update set a deadline to achieving the load reductions no later than 2035. Annually, stakeholders provide information on management actions, including projects, programs, and activities that reduce nutrient loads to the Indian River Lagoon. And as of December 2021, for the Northern IRL BMAP area, 249 projects have been completed, with an estimated to achieve reductions of 121,000 pounds per year of total nitrogen, which is roughly about 48% of the reduction needed for the total nitrogen TMDL. And projects completed to date are estimated to achieve reductions of over 24,000 pounds per year of total phosphorus, which is roughly 53% of the reduction needed. For the Banana River Lagoon, 252 projects have been completed and ongoing, which is estimated to achieve reductions of over 54,000 pounds of total nitrogen per year, which is 42% of the reduction. And for total phosphorus, 6,791 pounds, which is about 37% of the reductions needed. And lastly, for the Central IRL, 312 projects completed or ongoing, estimated to achieve reductions of over 255,000 pounds of total nitrogen, which is 28% of the reduction needed. And projects completed for total phosphorus is roughly almost 59,000 pounds per year, which is 40% of the reductions needed. And in addition, we have about 173 projects planned in all three basins. So when we're evaluating the improvement and what ecological response that we're seeing, we're primarily focused on seagrass because that's what determines what the water quality criteria is. We want the water quality to be to where it supports healthy seagrass. And so we do those assessments to determine whether we're seeing that ecological response. We also look at what the water quality is numerically for nutrients, and then being able to compare those nutrient criteria to establish the net improvement. And lastly, as we see and fund and have projects come to completion, then we assess the amount of nutrients that were actually reduced. Well, typically, as we develop our BMAPs, we get projects from stakeholders that have generalized amounts of nutrient reduction based on best available science and information. But then once those projects are completed, then we do assessments to determine what actual reductions were made, so those get credited to the amount of nutrients that they're responsible for under the BMAP. And in addition to the three BMAPs, we also have a reasonable assurance plan. This is basically the same as a BMAP, but it's a stakeholder-driven process where it's entered into voluntarily by all the entities that are responsible for the nutrient impairment in the Mosquito Lagoon. The Mosquito Lagoon RAP has a plan to restore water quality within 15 years. Reductions in nutrients and chlorophyll A have been observed based on project implementation. And the primary sponsors of the RAP are the City of Edgewater, New Smyrna Beach, City of Oak Hill, Department of Transportation, and Volusia County. The state, with support of the legislature, has provided significant funding over the last 4 years for the Indian River Lagoon, more than $325 million. $165 million from the wastewater grant program, $68 million from legislative water projects, $73 million from other water quality projects, and most recently, we took $20 million to address stormwater from our total maximum daily load program to be able to address stormwater, which is type of project not eligible under the current wastewater grant program and provides a significant contribution to nutrients within the IRL. So the governor, through his executive order 2306, continues to support the restoration of the Indian River Lagoon. In particular, this directed the department to work with the legislature to establish the IRL protection program and secure at least $100 million annually for priority projects to improve water quality in the Indian River Lagoon. Coordinate with stakeholders, including federal agencies, local governments, water management districts, the Indian River Lagoon National Estuary Program, to expand our partnerships and identify and prioritize projects for water quality restoration, undertake an enhanced water quality monitoring in the IRL to better identify sources of nutrient loading, and to be able to inform our project prioritization, and take actions to reduce nutrient contributions from septic tanks and wastewater facilities, stormwater discharges, and agricultural non-point sources. And lastly, support innovative nature-based solutions in coastal wetland restoration, seagrass recovery, and utilizing strategic propagation and planting efforts. And as part of the governor's recommended budget, there was also a proposed conforming bill. This primarily requires the evaluation and update of the various Indian River Lagoon BMAPs and RAP every 5 years, mandatory 5-year milestones, and must include water quality monitoring sufficient to evaluate that progress, identify projects necessary to achieve water quality standards to meet the total maximum daily loads, and implement an Indian River Lagoon watershed research and water quality monitoring program. For the identifying projects necessary to achieve those standards and meet the TMDL, one of the focuses is mandating in our BMAPs that projects are identified that are going to meet each of those milestone areas so that we can get a concise path forward of how those allocation reductions are going to be achieved. So at the end of the planning cycle, we've identified the projects, what needs to be done, and then have those five-year milestones to ensure that those projects and reductions are being done in a sufficient and timely manner. And lastly, in the conforming bill, as far as addressing septic tanks, the proposed language would apply in the Banana River Lagoon, Indian River Lagoon, BMAP, North Indian, Central IRL, sorry, North IRL, and Mosquito Lagoon RAP areas. So beginning January 1, 2024, for new construction, no new septic tanks where sewer is available, and where sewer is not available, requiring enhanced nutrient-reducing septic tanks. And then for existing systems, beginning in July 1, 2030, connecting to sewer, requiring connection to sewer where available, and upgrading to enhance nutrient-reducing septic tanks where sewer is not available. And the main concern in the IRL is septic tanks. It's one of the primary contributors along with stormwater, and being able to ensure that as we're funding and supporting the removal of septic tanks, that we're not seeing new septic tanks coming in behind, and also understanding that until some of the existing septic tanks are taken offline, those water quality improvements are not going to be seen. And so putting in some, and with the availability of the significant grant funding that's available to help offset some of those costs, something that in order to see a healthy Indian River Lagoon is necessary. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Oberdorf.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Just a couple questions for you. You know, you have, in one of your slides, you talked about load reduction by 2035. And you also stated that there were, and adding them all up, 813, quote unquote, projects were completed. What's a typical project? And meaning that there's 813 of them, obviously that's a heck of a lot. But what is a typical project?
Yeah, thank you. And a lot of those are going to be septic to sewer projects, advanced waste treatment upgrades, stormwater projects. Those are the main contributors within the IRL watersheds and in those BMAP areas. So those are going to be the primary. And they can range from, you know, taking off a street of septic tanks to neighborhoods. And so just depending on the size and scale, depends on kind of the cost of each of those projects.
The load reduction by 2035, does that currently take into account the projected growth that has taken off through that area?
Chair. Yeah, as we establish our basin management action plans, we look at, you know, what is at the year that it was first developed. You know, we look at the land use map and designations, and at each update that we do, we go and do a renewed analysis of that. So each time that we're, and we look at our BMAPs annually, but we do formal updates typically every 5 years in the IRL particularly. And so we're always updating the land use assessments and where you see conversions from maybe agriculture to residential. Will then add increased load reductions to make up for that increase in development.
Thank you, Chairman. One last question. You talked about that you're constantly updating the BMAPs, et cetera, but when was the last time that you actually updated the TMDLs for specific items? And in so doing, when was the last time that you actually enforced a TMDL on a property owner?
So the TMDLs, we will typically evaluate the TMDL as we're doing the update, but we generally don't need to update the TMDL because the TMDL is just, we know for a water body how much of a nutrient, in this case nitrogen and phosphorus, that water body can hold. Really what gets updated is predicting what the, by reducing the load allocation to meet that TMDL, are we seeing that direct benefit to the ecosystem. So the loading in and of itself is typically stable, and there are occasions where we've updated it if the data has showed it, but with the IRL being a relatively new BMAP, the data that we have for what the total maximum load is has not been necessary to update, but when we go and do the updates for the load allocations, that's where modeling kind of plays in, because we have to model this level of reduction is accomplished, are we going to see the off improved on environmental improvement? And so that's what will typically get updated, are those models to address allocations.
I apologize. One last thing then. You've got, within the IRL being so dynamic, you said 813 projects completed. We now have the C44 project online. You've got private industry that's now taking nutrients out as well, heading into the IRL on the St. Lucie and the C44. It just kind of mystifies me that you're saying that we stay the same as far as the TMDLs, and yet it just doesn't make sense to me that you're keeping TMDLs the same. You know the load going in, and it's not changing yet. Also, the city of Port St. Lucie and that entire area is one of the fastest growing in the entire state. So it would seem to me that that's counterintuitive to what you're telling me.
Yeah, and let me restate, because I probably wasn't clear. So the TMDL is saying, for this water body to be healthy, this is the max loading. We'll look at what actual loading is going in, and that can go up or down, as you said, as things get taken offline or growth, we add more to it. So what gets changed is how much has to be reduced. So we could say if, the Indian River County, we said you need to reduce by 100 pounds of nitrogen, but then they have growth and they added, 100 septic tanks or a development, then we're going to go back in the next update and be like, well, actually, now you need to reduce by 200 pounds. And so same thing if we saw discharges from the C44 get reduced because of reservoir or other things, and there's a decrease in the amount of nutrients. The TMDL is the same because that's just the maximum loading, but it's the allocations and the amount of reduction necessary that's constantly changing in order to meet that TMDL.
Thank you.
Thank you. Those are all good questions. Representative Cross, and then I think Representative Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Overdorf, for some great questions. Mr. Blalock, wanted to go back to the question about population growth, and you manage using looking at land use maps. Is there any consideration of using some of the information from the Bureau of Economic Research for some of that future population growth?
Thank you. Yeah, good question, and that is the case. We do use that to see what increased populations are going to be when we're establishing our load reductions. And then as we do those updates, then looking to see, did we get what were the actual increases? But yes, that information, we get reports annually from EDR on that to help us in those establishing those load allocations.
Representative Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Blalock, for, I probably see you at least twice a week, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell, on slide 5, can you tell me a little bit about how many key stations are there in the lagoon and the tributaries where you take your actual measurements? And then I have a follow-up.
Sure. Yeah, we have monitoring locations all throughout. I can get you the kind of exact numbers, but we do monitoring through the Division of Environmental Assessment and Restoration. Our aquatic preserves in those areas do monitoring and assessments. There's also some of the estuary program and some NGO groups they'll provide. So there's a large monitoring network within the IRL, which has been good because of the data availability. But I can get you more specific numbers on that.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chair, for a follow-up. How often are the measurements taken?
So we assess our water bodies statewide every 2 years to determine impairment. We do assessments, obviously, particularly in the BMAP areas, much more frequently. We'll go out and take water quality sampling because we do annual reviews and reporting of our BMAP areas and impaired water bodies. But in general, we evaluate every 2 years every water body in the state to determine whether they're impaired or not impaired. And so those assessments are done and data is collected throughout those two-year cycles. So it's relatively frequently, again, specifically for the IRL. I can get a little bit more because that's also some monitoring is done by the Water Management District, both St. John's and South Florida. But yeah, I can find a little bit more direct response for you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have one last question. You have $100 million, I understand, it's going to be appropriated every year. Are you all actually spending the entire $100 million every year? Are you rolling money over to the next year?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, one thing that we saw with the wastewater grant program is the significant need statewide. We've funded over $100 million just last year on money from the wastewater grant program, TMDL program, and other pots. And we know the investment needed as far as assisting with septic tank removals. We've not had any specific, at least from this program to that extent, appropriated specifically for the IRL to be able to say whether. But we know just based on the number of projects that we've gotten in that area that it would be well over $100 million that we could get qualified projects for each year.
One last, you brought up something for me. You talked about the septic tanks. Do we have a number? Do we know how many septic tanks are coming offline and we're going to sewer? Do we have a real number and what that looks like financially, dollar-wise?
Sure. As far as which one's coming offline, I have to go back and look at all the projects and what each project has because it varies from project to project. But we know that just on the properties adjoining the Indian River Lagoon, that there's over 10,500 septic tanks just bordering the Indian River Lagoon. And you go out, you know, broader into the BMAP area, and you're looking at, you know, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of septic tanks within that BMAP area, but I can get you again, sorry, like the number from all the projects we've funded in the last 4 years, what that reduction in septic tanks are. It's a lot.
Thank you. Any other, I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You're right behind me and I. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, sir. I'm wondering. What any update, if you have any at all, on the outfall pipes still operating. I know we have them in my Palm Beach County and believe there's one operating in Miami. I'm not sure the rest of the state, but what relevance do they have to the, you know, exchange of waters via the canals and the inlets into the intercoastal, and where are we on closing off those pipes?
And I'm not familiar with the outfalls in that specific location. I mean, obviously, if there's wastewater being discharged directly to Indian River Lagoon, if it's not meeting advanced waste treatment, it's gonna attribute to the load and whatever entity would be responsible for reducing that load. But that's something I'd have to get back to you with. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Cassell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I echo Representative Hart's sentiments. We see each other quite often during the week, so thank you again for your presentation. Obviously, in this committee, we are already starting to meet with various stakeholders that have requests for appropriations. What would you say is the biggest priority project, or what is the type of project that's going to give us the biggest bang or return for our dollar in making sure that we're, you know, contributing in a positive manner to reduce the nitrates and phosphates? Is it getting that septic to sewer transition? Is it the wastewater? If you had to pick your priority projects, what would that be to help us most?
Yeah, for the IRL, it's septic tanks, and then as you're expanding sewer, is having those wastewater facilities treating to advanced waste treatment so that the amount of nutrients being taken offline from septic tanks is then treated to a level that is going to meet the water quality criteria. And just for, I'm sorry, Representative Hart, we've removed in the last 4 years 8,500 septic tanks with the funding. Sorry.
I have a couple of questions. I know the boundaries. A few questions about the South Indian River Lagoon boundary. And I assume that would be Indian River, St. Lucie, Martin, Palm Beach County. Mm-hmm. Have they established the TMDLs for those areas as well?
Yes. So for the, there's the St. Lucie estuary that's part of the Northern Everglades 3.
Right.
And so there are TMDLs that cover the very southern end of the IRL. And then you know, going into the central IRL and northern IRL covers the breadth of the entire lagoon. And then the Mosquito Lagoon wrap covers that far northern area.
Does the governor's executive order cover the entire Indian River Lagoon region, or is it just from central to the north, with the South going into those other projects related?
Under the conforming bill, would be
a conforming bill, I meant to say,
yeah. Yeah, it would be for projects that are within the wrap and those two BMAPs. So the very farther extent where the St. Lucie Northern Everglades, I don't want to say it wouldn't apply to the funding wouldn't apply to those, but the septic tank requirement and all of those that are specific to the Indian River Lagoon BMAPs, because there's additional funding and programs, because a lot of what we're doing with the conforming bill is mirrored off of that Northern Everglades Protection Program legislation in 373-4595, which includes the St. Lucie, so this would be basically incorporating that up into the Indian River Lagoon.
That's fantastic. It definitely is a need. A lot of folks felt that was overlooked, but we're very appreciative of the governor's effort to incorporate that with what you're doing down in St. Lucie and Palm Beach. It's a great program. But thank you so much for, I don't think we have any other questions, but thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you very much. It was good to do it. Thank you.
Okay. I think that pretty much concludes our committee agenda. Is there any further business questions? Anything coming for the? All right. With that said, Representative Cassell moves. We rise without objection. So the meeting is adjourned.